Russell Foster, who is chair of circadian neuroscience, Nicholas Curti Fellow, and head of Department of Ophthalmology at Oxford University. His work investigates how light regulates circadian rhythms. He has a very extensive and very impressive publication list with many papers in Nature Science and Nature Neuroscience. The title of his talk is Uncovering the Brain's Role in Food and Obesity. That's not it. Where is your
head? It's changed. I've just been a bit more.
It's also changed. I'll let him take it from here then.
So it's light, clock, sleep, obesity, and an integrative approach. I should start by first saying how delighted I am to be here, but also with a confession. I don't work on metabolism, and I don't work on obesity. I suppose you could think of me more of an obesity voyeur. That sounds a bit pervy. I mean, what I mean is, essentially, I'm interested in the potential overlap between obesity and mental health and a relationship to sleep and circadian rhythms disruption, which is really what I'd like to discuss in the next 15 minutes. I thought, for this particular audience, we would have a brief overview of sleep and circadian systems, and then also go into sleep and circadian rhythm disruption, and then use these two bits of information to think of a framework of connecting sleep and circadian rhythms with obesity, and then also think of sleep and circadian rhythms as a potential therapeutic target to perhaps mitigating some of the problems associated with obesity. And then a few minor conclusions at the end. So let's start with the background and the sleep-wake cycle. Now, we're going to unpack this horrendously complicated box in a few moments. But what I'd like to start with is think about the drivers and modulators of sleep and circadian rhythms. And the first, of course, is this extraordinary structure in the anterior hypothalamus, the circadian pacemaker or the suprachiasmatic nuclei. I'll talk a little bit more about this in a moment, but its critical role as a modulator of the sleep-wake cycle is that it's providing the cue, which says now it's the appropriate time to be awake, now it's the appropriate time to be asleep, and it's very likely, we don't understand how everything in here is feeding back upon this oscillator. Now let's just talk about this oscillator in a little bit more detail. In the anterior hypothalamus, it's a paired structure, the suprachiasmatic nuclei. And we now know that individual SCN neurons are capable of generating a 24-hour circadian oscillation. And the mechanisms behind that are becoming reasonably well described. You have essentially a molecular feedback loop. And I won't go into the details of that now. But what turned out to be extraordinary is that we thought that the SCN would simply drive all these various aspects of rhythmic physiology and behavior, whether it's a neurohormonal output, whether it's a behavioral output, or indeed whether it's a response to a particular stimulus. Now we appreciate that the molecular machinery in individual SCN neurons is present in essentially every cell in the body. And so what the SCN is doing is not as a driver, but rather like the conductor of an orchestra, producing a regular signal from which the multiple billion oscillators in the rest of the body take their cue and then align physiology appropriately. And in fact, one interesting area that may be associated with mental health and perhaps even obesity is a disconnect, an internal desynchronization with this driver here, this conductor here within the SCN, and the way it's able to regulate the rest of rhythmic physiology. Okay, so that's the SCN. The other really important modulator is, I suppose, the intuitive part of sleep, which is the homeostatic drive. The longer you've been awake, the greater the sleep pressure, the greater the need for sleep. And substances such as the buildup of adenosine within certain regions of the brain have been suggested as providing the homeostatic sleep drive for sleep. And of course, again, there's going to be an incredibly important feedback loop here. The longer you've slept, the reduction in sleep pressure, and the reduced homeostatic drive. So these two are the timers, if you like. But there's going to be multiple other inputs. The first is social behavior, as I've illustrated here with an alarm clock. The alarm clock wakes most people up in the morning. It will force a sleep-wake cycle. This behavior will then ripple around the rest of the things and have certainly feedback upon the homeostat and probably the clock. So social behaviors, whatever they may be, alarm clock, child crying, other social pressures are going to be very important here. Then we can talk about the pineal and pineal melatonin. This is much discussed, and it's often called a sleep hormone. That is not appropriate. Of course, melatonin is produced at night by the pineal, and that's the case for a nocturnal rodent, or indeed a diurnal species such as ourselves. Now, in us, it probably does have some impact upon sleep. It probably feeds back and provides a biological representation of the dark, consolidating the SCN pacemaker, but also an acute direct effect upon sleep in this box here. Only in about 70% of people will melatonin, 3 milligrams of melatonin, actually lower the latency for sleep. Then we move on to other modulators, the light-dark cycle. And this is an area that we've worked on intensively. The light-dark cycle will set the phase of the clock. So if I were to stay in Canada for a bit longer, eventually my internal clock will be set to the local light-dark cycle. But as a result of remarkable photoreceptors in the eye, very different from the rods and cones, one of our contributions has been to show that there's another class of light receptor based upon light-sensitive ganglion cells, which are detecting this light in the eye and setting the clock. Light will, of course, also modulate the pineal, and hence its feedback upon the clock, and also its direct sleep-inducing effect within this box here. And then a very critical element is that these new photoreceptors, which we know are regulating the clock, are also providing brightness or irradiance information to multiple structures within the brain, associated with not only the sleep-wake cycle, and this is just sort of a quick diagram we sort of put together the other day, but essentially these novel photoreceptors within the brain are regulating multiple structures within the thalamus and the hypothalamus. So much of the hypothalamus and thalamus is going to be under direct input from a light sensor. Right. So, as promised you, I'd unpack this box here. That, we've just talked about sort of the modulators, but what's in this structure, what's in here? And just horribly complicated. There are multiple brain structures throughout the hindbrain, the midbrain, and the forebrain and the hypothalamus that are regulating sleep. It's a complete bloody mess. And it's important for you to appreciate this. And what I want to do next is try and place all of this sort of stuff into some sort of coherent framework. If we think about the wake state, we see all of those various brain structures producing a raft of different neurotransmitter systems, histamine, dopamine, noradrenaline, serotonin, acetylcholine, all bathing the cortex and keeping us awake. How are they driven? Well, we've already heard Dennis speak about orexin, but what's really very, very interesting is that orexin is providing the primary driver for these structures in the brain allowing us to be awake. And that, of course, is in turn driven by the lateral hypothalamus. So the lateral hypothalamus via orexin is keeping us awake. Also, the monoaminergic system is feeding back upon this structure here that we'll talk about in a moment, called the VELPO, which will induce sleep. It's turning off the sleep drive via the VELPO. And also the lateral hypothalamus is turning off a group of neurons in the midbrain which are stopping us falling into REM sleep. And, as Dennis was saying, orexin hypocretin is not only regulating the wake state, but as we've heard so elegantly from his work, is also very much involved in increasing appetite. So we already have an immediate overlap between the mechanisms that are critical for the wake state and, of course, for appetite. If we now drop into non-REM sleep, we see a powerful influence by adenosine. Adenosine, possibly by the basal forebrain, is then inhibiting the inhibitory drive onto the VELPO, the ventrolateral preoptic nuclei, which are in turn turning off the lateral hypothalamus and all of those structures that we talked about earlier, keeping us awake. So this is the classic sleep switch described by Cliff Saper, and it's modulated by adenosine probably directly as well, and that allows us to go into sleep. And I should add that the SCN, melatonin and light, of course, will be modulating all these structures. And then for the sake of completeness, non-REM sleep involves an activation, finally, of the REM promoting neurons which give atonia, paralysis, and allow acetylcholine to be released from these structures here. The point I'm trying to make is that sleep and circadian systems draw upon most of the neurotransmitter systems within the brain, and that's an important thing that we'll come back to later. Okay, so let's now consider sleep-wake disruption. In general, the consequences of sleep-wake disruption are huge. If we just think about one of particular relevance to us, weight gain and metabolic problems. Beautiful work from the University of Chicago has shown that sleep loss is directly related to elevated levels of ghrelin, perhaps working via orexin, increasing hunger and promoting weight gain. Conversely, sleep has been shown to be associated with elevation of leptin, decreased hunger and weight loss. So again, an immediate overlap between the metabolic systems and the sleep systems. If we also think about decreased motor performance and decreased cognition, really very important here. This is a rested brain, an fMRI scan, performing mathematical tasks, lots and lots of brain areas active. Here is the sleep-deprived brain, not a great deal of activity going on. And this sort of really illustrates the impact of sleep in processing by the brain. And the problem is that brains like this, tired brains, then indulge in increased sedative and stimulant use. And a particular problem is both tired adults and tired children. The wake state is often fueled by caffeine, either in Red Bull, coffee, Clopras, and of course it's caffeine that's antagonizing the effects of adenosine, making you want to go to sleep. These substances can have a long half-life, and of course then there's the need to try and sedate yourself at night to get some sleep. And so much of Western society, in one form or another, is involved in a stimulant sedative feedback loop. And of course, smoking is now rather more prevalent in youngsters than it was actually even 10 years ago. And of course, as is alcohol use as a sedative. Both of these, all these factors will all interact, again, to provide a major impact upon metabolism. Prediction. If sleep-wake disruption is a genuine significant factor in predisposing individuals to obesity, then obesity will be comorbid with multiple pathologies. The question I'd like to ask this audience is, okay, we've talked about the relationship between sleep loss and weight gain. What other of these comorbid pathologies that you find in sleep deprivation are also comorbid with obesity? And can we use, perhaps, some of these features as a better endophenotype for certain subsets of obesity? And that's a question maybe we'll have time to discuss. Well, let's now think about a framework for connecting all of this. Here we have obesity, and I think we'd all agree that obesity would be underpinned in some form by an abnormal pattern of neurotransmitter release. If we have an abnormal pattern of neurotransmitter release here, we're almost certainly going to affect the sleep and circadian systems. As I try to illustrate, sleep will draw upon many neurotransmitters and brain structures. The problem then, of course, is that if it disrupts sleep, you're going to precipitate a range of other problems: activation of the stress axis, disrupted social behavior, abnormal light-dark exposure, and comorbid pathologies such as these. So, could sleep circadian systems provide a useful therapeutic target? If we stabilize these, will it stabilize this to a greater extent and prevent, reduce some of the predisposition for obesity? And so with that in mind, let's think now as sleep as a therapeutic target. This is the model that we showed earlier, sleep-wake cycle and all these various modulators. And where could we modulate sleep exogenously? Well, the first, of course, would be fix the light-dark cycle, using light-dark cycles that optimize to those new photoreceptors that we were talking about. Fix that, and that will, of course, stabilize sleep-wake throughout the whole system. Melatonin agonists, essentially this biological representation of the dark. Would you help consolidate sleep with melatonin agonists? Very important here, enhance the light environment during the day. Reduce the need, perhaps, for exogenous stimulants such as caffeine. fixed meal and social activities, not only within the context, of course, of regulating metabolic input, but also in terms of using these cues throughout the sleep and circadian timing systems. And then finally, maybe we should think about agonists or antagonists of the adenosine receptors, essentially modulating that homeostatic drive and trying to align the homeostatic drive with the circadian drive to regulate the sleep-wake cycle. So what I've tried to sort of talk about is give you some sense of the background and the importance of sleep and circadian timing systems and its complexity. Talk about the consequence of disruption of sleep and circadian timing systems and a raft of well-documented comorbid problems, including metabolic problems and a predisposition to obesity. And then we talked about a framework whereby some of the mechanisms that might predispose you to obesity might be common to the sleep-wake timing systems. So we might, in some forms of obesity, almost always expect some sleep or circadian rhythm disruption. And then we finished with some discussion, as maybe we could think of targeting and consolidating sleep as a way of augmenting some of the ways of reducing the predisposition to obesity. Thank you for your attention.
Talk. Okay.
Thanks. That was lovely. You mentioned two things, one more obvious and one in passing, Cliff Saper and histamine. And I was wondering if you'd considered the histamine system as a potential target, although you've talked about other things.
Yep.
But it appears as to be very central and very powerful to the regulation of
sleep. I think that's an extremely good point. And I think what I would try to do with that diagram is that we have a series of potential targets, I think, there. We could attack several of them, I think, simultaneously. Yeah. Very good. We can barely hear you down the front. I think a microphone's coming up.
Someone asked earlier about the issue of night eating syndrome, which I think you would be in a better position to talk about, I would hope. And Stunkard wrote about this and wrote continuously since the 50s about night eating syndrome. Would you comment on the circadian factors that might drive that condition?
Well, I think that it is an extremely important area because, of course, what the clock is doing is fine-tuning physiology and behavior for the varying demands of activity and rest. And where we see a real mismatch between what the clock is saying and what society is imposing is in shift work. You can be on the shift work, night shift, for 20 years, and your body clock does not adapt with the demands of working at night. Why? Because you're locked onto the light-dark cycle like everybody else. And, of course, the clock needs a relatively bright exposure to light. So relatively dim light conditions in the factory will not shift the clock compared to the brighter light conditions that the individual will experience during the day. And so what's happening is that there's a cognitive override for the body to be asleep. And so gut function, for example, is in the resting state, whereas, of course, food is being forced into it. It's really very interesting that in many night shift workers, ulcers are a common problem. The other interesting bit of work from the University of Surrey has looked at the absorption of triglycerides over the 24-hour day and has shown that during the day you can sort of clear some of these triglycerides, but at night the clearance is much lower. And again, night shift work has been correlated with increased levels of coronary heart disease. Is it this metabolic axis, this inability to clear some of the triglycerides as effectively? So I think it's part of a really much bigger picture of taking internal time into account in body processing of rest and activity cycles. Thank you.
I'm also a clinician. I look after patients with Parkinson's disease who have terrible sleep problems, all kinds. But one of the things that we're told...
One of the extraordinary things about that is we've got a deep PhD student looking at the effect of anticholinesterases on those individuals. So when you give them in the morning, they cause nausea, or in the evening, and of course they elevate acetylcholine, one of the arousal hormones, so no wonder you get sleep disturbance. It's extraordinary. I mean, that's a very interesting set of questions.
But one of the things I tell patients who have insomnia,
yeah,
is to avoid caffeine after noon, because there seems to be this effect that if you drink caffeinated beverages in the afternoon, it causes insomnia, but you know, at 2 in the morning.
Yeah, I think the half-life is for getting rid of sort of caffeine is quite long in some individuals. And as you age, the liver function declines, and so the clearance of things like caffeine is lower. So, yes, I've seen those papers. You know, anything afternoon, you will significantly delay bedtime rest as a result of those stimulants. And that's, of course, part of that stimulant-sedative feedback loop. You know, kids or adults will realize they've got to get some sleep, and they just don't feel sleepy because they've been fueling the wake state with these agonists of adenosine, and then the temptation is to use alcohol and other sedatives, which would sedate but then further disrupt sleep, requiring more stimulants during the day and this ghastly feedback loop.
Let me ask one quick question, and then I'll pass it on. I'm just wondering, is there any individual variation in the light ganglion cells or the adenosine switch that might map onto variation in BMI or insulin sensitivity?
Again, fantastic question. We don't know. I mean, the biology of those photosensitive ganglion cells on human biology is really in its infancy, and one of the great things we hope to develop here with McGill is access to some of those sort of really interesting patient populations you've got here. So, for example, in schizophrenia, there's appalling sleep-wake timing problems. And you could argue it either way. Is the clock more sensitive to light and therefore being shifted all around by normal room lighting conditions, or profoundly insensitive, which means that in many people we see the whole clock just drifting? So, great question. Don't know the answer, I'm afraid.
Is adenosine the only known factor that controls sleep homeostasis?
No, thank you for raising that. No, there's probably a series of other homeostatic drivers. The interleukins, for example, there's pretty good evidence for those. Adenosine has been the best studies and fits all the criteria. You know, infuse adenosine into the brain, you can promote sleep. Using agonists of adenosine, you can sort of pull back sleep pressure. But there will be others, absolutely.
From your last or before last slides, when you were giving kind of the recipe, what was striking for me is in many ways how you are close to what Charles was talking about, which is let's know biology and let's try to shape our environment in a way that make it friendly.
I think this, and particularly with the sleeping clock systems, and, you know, sleep is so often regarded as some sort of an illness that needs a cure, and we simply marginalize it, and yet it's a fundamental part of our biology.
So as an outsider to obesity, I think you have great insights to give both the industry and the nutritionists. What would you say? Because it's true that you haven't been working in obesity, but mm-hmm. there's so much reflect a deep understanding of the human machine there. So what advice can you give?
Well, in the same way, in our sort of a parallel approach that we're taking with mental health, we're looking at abnormal sleep-wake phenotypes in schizophrenia, for example. We've recently taken a gene that's been linked to schizophrenia, mutated that in a mouse, and examined what the sleep phenotype in that mouse is. And actually, it's just like the patient's. It's extraordinary, showing a direct mechanistic overlap between, you know, what's driving sleep-wake and presumably predisposing schizophrenia at some level. So I think by analogy, maybe what we should do is take some of these really nice mouse models for obesity and try and look at the sleep and circadian timing systems in those animals. So that will be one way forward, an immediate way forward, and indeed some people are doing that.
Okay, let's thank Professor Foster for a fascinating